does a Christian philosopher find truth in a secular age? What is peculiar about the modern self? What can the Bible tell us about finding love? This week, Christian theologian and philosopher Carl Truman on 9 Questions with Eric Oliver.
Good evening, Dre. How are you?
Good evening. How are you, Eric?
You know, every time I say good evening, Dre, how are you? You never say a direct
how
answer.
How I'm doing.
You just deflect back a question right to me.
I'm doing really good. I'm having a cocktail. I'm enjoying my evening. We're going to talk about Carl. It's going to be delicious.
Yes. Well, I am very excited for this week's episode because we have a Christian theologian on.
Yeah.
And given that it's Christmas time, I thought this was an appropriate time to air this segment. And the fact that we haven't really had anybody who we've spoken to about Christianity and how someone from a deep Christian set of convictions might understand themselves. And considering that's how most people in this country understand the world, it's about time.
Yeah, I think it is about time.
All right. So tell everyone a little bit about Carl.
Carl Truman is a Christian theologian and ecclesiastical historian. He was professor of historical theology and church history at Westminster Theological Seminary, where he held the Paul Woolley Chair of Church History. In 2018, he became a professor at Grove City College in Pennsylvania. He has published several books, including The Creedal Imperative, Republicrat, Confessions of a Liberal Conservative, and most recently in 2020, The Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self.
Yeah, I was very excited to have Carl on. I loved his last book. It's a very interesting take on kind of the rise of modern identity politics and tracing its intellectual history going all the way back to the Enlightenment. And here is a guy who has kind of a deep Christian conviction, but is well read in modern philosophy and intellectual life.
Yeah.
And I saw some of his talks on YouTube, and he's a lively, charming, friendly guy. And I thought this would be a great person to really share with me a kind of a deep Christian perspective on the self, and particularly somebody who has reflected and written a book about the rise of the modern self. And we had a really interesting conversation that weaves in and out of Christianity and philosophy and Marxism and bridging some of our different intellectual gaps. And I really enjoy talking with Carl. I'm really happy to share this episode with everyone. Oh, and one last thing. Sorry if the audio quality is a little sketchy on this one. We were doing it on Zoom over the summer with a shaky Wi-Fi network, but hopefully it won't be too much of a distraction. Carl, once again, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. And we'll start with the first question, which is, what are you?
Well, first of all, I'm a living being, I guess I would say. I'm different to a stone or a block of ice. I have blood flowing through my veins. So I would want to say, first of all, I'm not simply a lump of matter. I'm a particular form of matter that's alive and animate. Then I'd want to go further and say, I'm also an intentional being. Not only do I have life, but I also have freedom and intention. I choose where I work. I choose the friends I have. I have a conception of the future that I move myself into via the intentions that I have. And I think, you know, how does that then shape how I think of my place in the world? I would say it gives me a profound sense of being free. It gives me a profound sense that to an extent, maybe this is a bad way of putting it, but to an extent, I can invent myself. I'm able to create who I am at some level. Now, it's more complicated than that, because when we come to the who question in a couple of questions, I think probably then I'm going to talk about I'm also a creature who wants to belong. And that's where relationships come in. But at a basic level, I think what distinguishes a human being from the rest of animal species is we're able to behave and act intentionally and creatively.
When you say that you have the ability to build yourself, then what are the constituent elements that are coming into that construction?
Well, then I think you start to get into, at one level, there are trivial things. I choose what I have for breakfast. I choose which particular brand of bourbon or whiskey that I enjoy, et cetera, et cetera, or whether I enjoy them at all. But I think there are also profounder points here. And this is where a broader understanding or intuition about the world kicks in. Am I totally free in the sense of, is my freedom the ability simply to choose in a disinterested manner? Or am I, as a human being, free to flourish by choosing the good and the true, by conforming myself to some transcendent order? And that's where I think differences between myself and others might also kick in. Not only would I say I'm an intentional being, but Jean-Paul Sartre, I think if he was online now, would say, well, he believes that too. Difference between myself and Sartre would be, I'd say, yes, but as a Christian, I think human beings made in the image of God were actually made to flourish by conforming to some pattern greater than the individual will.
Can we delve into that a little bit more? Once again, the spirit of this question is understanding your conception of what you are, what it does for you. So can you share a little bit about what that, the Christian notion of being made in the image of God, if that is, you know, what we are, what does that do for you? How does that guide your understanding of your own lived experience?
Yeah, I think it gives me a sense that I am somebody who is to act for an end, and an end beyond myself. That the purpose of my life is not my self-fulfillment. The purpose of my life is to fulfill my obligations to those around us and to fulfill my obligations towards God. So it curtails my sense of autonomy, if you like, is not a libertarian sense of autonomy, free to be whatever I want, whoever I want, whenever I want. My sense of autonomy is the sense of I'm free to take responsibility for who I am and to act in accordance with that.
Great. Well, you just are leading us into what is question number two, which is, what is your purpose?
Well, as a Presbyterian, I'd point you to the first answer of the our shorter catechism. Man's chief end is to glorify God and enjoy him forever. So I think as a Christian would say, I have purposes on two levels, I suppose. The ultimate purpose of human life for the Christian is the love and the worship of God. But of course, I happen not to be in heaven at the moment. I'm here on earth. So how does that play out in terms of this earthly sphere? And here I would go to, I've been very helped by the writings of St. Augustine, the 5th century North African bishop, who talks about orders of love. And for Augustine, there is one thing to be loved in and for itself, and that is God. And there are other things that are to be loved for the way they point us towards God and the way they benefit us here and now. So my purpose here on earth is to love the good and to do good and to commit myself to, say politically, to the public square and pursue goods that I see and perceive and share with those around us who may not share my faith, for example. So my Christian faith gives me an ultimate end. The end is God, but it also allows me to make sense of earthly goods and to work shoulder to shoulder with those who pursue those same earthly goods, even if they don't share my same overarching understanding of what it is to be human.
Can I ask you a follow-up on this? Because one of the things that comes up a lot in these conversations is, and people have different words for it. Sometimes they call it sort of divine energy. Sometimes they call it the spirit of the universe. Sometimes people call it God. And one thing that's common oftentimes is people say, well, that spirit, that energy is ineffable to us. It defies our ordinary comprehension, our ordinary sense perception. It transcends it. It goes beyond it. You know, it's like the Plato's analogy of the cave. And so I'm always then curious to hear how people themselves experience or try to make sense of that ineffable quality, if it indeed is ineffable to them.
And I was wondering if you could speak to that a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting way of putting it. I suspect in the Christian world, we make a distinction between the natural and the supernatural. And we don't divide those two things or set them over against each other. But certainly, Tom, I'm not a Catholic. Here I am quoting Thomas Aquinas again, but Aquinas makes the point that certain truths, certain goods, certain loves are available to us naturally. The love of a man for his wife, and certain loves are available and goods are available to us only supernaturally. The love of God, for example, and that does occur within the context of faith. So there's a sense in which one might say that those supernatural things are ineffable, except I would say that's qualified in the Christian tradition by the corporate aspect. If you're a Catholic, then these supernatural things come to you through the sacraments, which are always done in a corporate context, in the gathering of God's people. If you're a Protestant, it comes through the proclamation of God's word in language that can be understood by all, again, in the context of gathered worship. So I would say I shy away from sort of mystical talk about ineffable powers and prefer to think about the concrete actualization of what Christians see as supernatural in the sacraments and the proclamation of the word. I would also add that in terms of the natural goods, and again, I think this perhaps goes to the heart of perhaps one of the big differences in the world today, again, put it rather simplistically, is between those who think the world has a moral or a metaphysical shape and meaning and those who reject that. I think as a Christian, and I think Jews, Muslims would also affirm this, the natural world itself has an order and a shape to it, a moral order and a shape to it that makes sense of these things. For me, Christianity, again, is thinking of Cardinal Newman. Newman makes this point. Christianity was always a dogmatic religion. It was always making claims about reality that could be understood even by people who rejected them. And I think for me, yeah, Christianity is at core a dogmatic religion rather than a mystical religion.
All right, why don't we move to question three, which is who are you, comma, really?
Yeah, this is, it's a fascinating question. I would say on one level, well, I'm a human being made in the image of God. That's the Christian answer. But of course, that also applies to everybody else on the face of the earth. So what is it that makes me distinctive, I think, is the network of interpersonal relationships I have here in this world. I often say to students, I'll get them to engage in a thought experiment, and I'll say, you know, what would it be like to be you but to have been born in Japan in the 17th century to a samurai in a town in Japan? What would it be like to be you? And, of course, when the students start to think about that, a kind of intellectual vertigo sets in, and the answer usually comes back, actually, I don't know, because it wouldn't be me. So I strongly tilt towards in answering who I am really in terms of, well, generally speaking, I'm a person made in the image of God. In terms of my real concrete existence, I'm somebody who exists in relationship to a whole host of other unique persons, and that's what makes me who I am.
Yeah, and the who question is really a social question, and you know, our names, our other identities are what really mark us from the herd in that regard. And that's, we'll get into this later. And to me, some of the interesting things about the who question then is, well, how do those markers either both empower us or cause us problems down the line? And I'm wondering if, given your investigations into the sort of the evolution of the self over time, because one of the things I'm writing about in my book too is like, I start with the Delphic maxim, know thyself, which we all kind of interpret as, oh, it means I'm supposed to know, you know, who to really live authentically. I need to know this self, whatever that is. And that's probably a mistranslation of what the maxim really was. It probably really meant know thy place, which is, if you look across human history, across time, you know, who we were, our whole purpose, our whole meaning, everything was probably tightly prescribed by culture, tradition. And it's only in the past couple of hundred years that this has really gotten blown open. And in many ways, this is me analogous to sort of saying what you're saying in your book, which is we now face this dilemma of how do I find happiness, meaning, and purpose if I'm left to my own individual devices in a world where traditions have been so, you know, rendered asundered and the individual has, you know, achieved this primacy. And that's, you know, the reinterpretation of know thy place as know thyself, I think is symptomatic of this. And I think my whole project here, my book and the class I teach is also symptomatic of this in that way as well. So that's what I guess my long-winded way of coming back. And I'm curious if your writings and thinking about the self and the evolution of the self mm-hmm. has changed or informed your understanding of who you are in any kind of different way.
I think so. And one of the things that I'd never really thought about until I did the book was, I gave the answer earlier about freedom, intentionality, et cetera, et cetera. I think I'd never really understood how much belonging is also important to the human experience. And one of the reasons for that was I grew up in a rural town. Mum and dad stayed together their whole life. Family was very stable. School was very traditional. I grew up in a world where, to go back to your comment, you know thyself, to know thy place. My place was obvious and clear. So I never thought about it. I never had to wrestle with the question of belonging because I just belonged. What struck me with the rising generation, I became more acutely aware of this as I was working on the book, is how, for want of a better word, this the radical sort of libertarian self-determining view of the self that we are so proud of today creates a real problem for belonging. And when we look at the wider world around us, particularly the way technology is dissolving traditional ties, traditional notions of place, etc., that's not necessarily a liberating thing. It's depriving kids of social recognition in the technical sense of the word. It's depriving kids of stable frameworks for knowing who they are. And I became more and more aware of that as I was working on the book. And then when I moved back to teaching undergraduates in 2018, talking to undergraduates and realizing the levels of anxiety and mental health issues that one gets on campuses really made me start thinking that, yes, that freedom is only part of the story. Belonging is another part. And that's, I think, where the real problem in the present day lies. I was privileged. Maybe I was the last generation that grew up and belonging was just, I didn't even realize that that's what I had because it was the very water that I was swimming in. I think today we're seeing a great destabilizing of that. And it's raising this question of, it makes the question, who are you, 1,000 times more complicated than it was for my generation. I said, you know, when I was at school, I was part of a group of 7 or 8 guys. And they were the only people whose approval I needed. Uh-huh. If you're online now, there are this countless sea of people who are able to comment on your TikTok or your Instagram or your Facebook posts and give or withhold recognition. The ability to feel secure in oneself in my generation was far greater than today. And it's one of the reasons why I get very impatient, particularly with people in the conservative world who's complaining about snowflakes. I do think that being a young person today for this reason is incalculably harder than it was for people in my generation.
Yeah, I think especially because so many of those comments come from anonymous sources or people you don't know. And so there's this imagined scrutiny that's out there that, I think it's very psychologically destabilizing.
Yeah, I never read social media because it's paralyzing. I decided I just want to go and do my work. I get paralyzed by people. I don't know who they are. They don't care about me, and I shouldn't care about them.
Yeah. Question 4, which is, what are your dreams telling you?
My dreams at night or my aspirations?
Like I said, these are invitations for exploration. We can go wherever you want.
It's funny. My aspirations, such as they were, I've been very blessed. I think I've pretty much done everything I wanted to do. So in terms of dreams and ambitions, I don't really have many left for myself now, because I'm a man of limited ambition anyway, and I've fulfilled those limited ambitions. At night, I keep a journal. So often I will jot down what I dream about at night. Every now and then I'll look back, and I would say my jottings tell me I must be a very weird person in my unconsciousness. So that's probably about as good as I can do with that question, I think.
Well, let me follow up here a little bit, and maybe I'm curious about this, because we were talking about how you know understanding yourself through this intellectual framework and understanding yourself through them, you know, very kind of conscious and deliberate way. Yet dreams reveal to us the hidden contours of our unconscious minds.
Right.
And one thing I like to tell my students that, you know, when you're in the dream, we always identify ourselves with the protagonist of the dream, but because dreams are all self-fabricated, you know, we're also the dreamscape. We're the monster chasing us. We're the exam room that we haven't. And so how do you reconcile, on the one hand, a sort of a very kind of deliberate and intellectual and conscious ontology with this murky, you know, stew of dream life that percolates up?
I think it's, again, it's where I've actually, like Charles Taylor, I found the romantics very helpful. I think what the romantics do is they do bring to the fore the fact that we are not simply a collection of ideas, that we are passions and desires. And I say to the students in class, I teach a capstone humanities class. It was set up by a friend of mine in the faculty. And it was set up really very much as a history of epistemology over the last 300 years. And I say to the students, the problem with epistemology is nobody gets out of bed in the morning because of epistemology. You know, most of us just know stuff. We get out of bed because of the things we desire, maybe the things we hate, the things that touch our passions. And so when I think about my dreams from that level, I guess they're a corrective and a reminder to me that some of the most powerful things in my life and the things that shape how I operate in this world are not the ideas to which I'm committed intellectually. They're the people and the places I love. I dream about my dad every couple of times a year. My dad's been dead many, many years, but you know, death of my dad, probably the most devastating thing that ever happened to me. And I think that, you know, those dreams remind me, actually, in an odd way, that a lot of what I do and all I did it for my dad's approval, not in a bad Freudian Oedipal kind of way, but because I like to please my dad. And so I think dreams are a reminder to me, if I reflect upon them seriously, of the point I make in a rather cerebral way in class, and that is, we're not driven by epistemology. We're driven by the deep desires of the heart. And I think it also ties in with, again, with what I teach about Nietzsche. I try to bring out the truth that Nietzsche has for the students. But I'll ask the football players, what's the most satisfying thing you do on the college football field? And don't tell me it's scoring a touchdown, because I know you're lying. And they laugh and they say, it's punching the other guy in the face. And I say, absolutely, absolutely. Because we are also dark desires as well. And that's one of the things I learned from Nietzsche. I think I got it from Freud somewhat, but it may sound odd to have a Christian praising Nietzsche, but I think Nietzsche understands the darkness of the human soul in a way that is profound.
Well, can I then ask you, when your darkness gets revealed, you know, there's what Jung might have called the shadow self, you know, that comes out. What do you do with that?
Well, as a Christian, I'm supposed to confess it and repent of it, of course. But I have to say, the number of anecdotes I like to tell in class about trouble I've caused over the years would indicate that my repentance is far from complete at this particular point. I think it's helpful on level to remind students that there's a reason why utopianism doesn't work. And that is that we are at core quite dark, and we all understand that. So I would say practically, it's very useful to have a grasp of that for when we think about politics and what is possible in the public square and what is possible in our local community.
This kind of segues nicely into question five, which is how, not what, are you feeling?
One of the things that I think is important is that feelings need to be coordinated with or regulated by external circumstances. So if you were to say to me today, how are you feeling? Well, I'm feeling okay, but then in terms of just my emotional state. But then I reflect on something, for example, my granddaughter. I remember in Psalm 128 in the Old Testament says, may you live to see your children's children. And I'd always read that as, may you live a long time, until I held my granddaughter in my arms. And then I realized, wow, there is a particular delight and joy that comes from seeing the life that you created go on to create life. Mm-hmm. And so when you ask me how I'm feeling, I'm never going to just retreat into, okay, let me, do I have butterflies in my stomach? Am I feeling a bit up or a bit down? I want to immediately think about my external circumstances. How am I, what's my life contain at the moment that I would consider to be a privilege and a blessing and something for which I am to be grateful. So I don't know if that answers the question, but I would always want to get away from a merely subjective, hey, this is how my emotional register is at this moment, to how is my life connected to my broader life circumstances?
Well, maybe we can bring in something you write about in the book, which is, you know, you talk about how with modernity, the challenge of, please correct me if I'm getting this wrong, but how the challenge of modernity is, you know, we've come culturally to elevate our own emotional experience as the sort of basis of authenticity and truth for us. And that we find our truth in that emotional experience. And
okay.
Is that a fair characterization of one
I think
of your
so. Arguments? Yes. Okay. Yeah. And I think it sort of connects you. You find that in Nietzsche in some ways. And I think that's problematic. I think it derives in modernity, it derives from a highly autonomous and individualistic view of the self, I think, whereas the view of myself I've tried to articulate is that is connected to much broader social responsibilities. I think in the book, I use the example of my grandfather when I talk about job satisfaction. And I say, you know, if you ask my grandfather, did he get job satisfaction? Which, you know, was he happy in his job? And he was a sheet metal worker in a factory in Birmingham. He did what I would regard as a very boring, tedious, hard work. My grandfather, first of all, would not have understood the question because he wouldn't have thought in the kind of categories that I think it. And secondly, once I'd explained them to him and said, well, do you consider your job to be worthwhile, worth doing? He'd have answered, yeah, sure, because I put in a hard day's work and I get a fair day's pay. And that pay allows me to put bread on the table for my family and shoes on my children's feet. And that makes me happy. That, I think, is a very, very different answer to the one that I would give about whether I give job satisfaction or that most people today would think about in terms of happiness. But my grandfather, the concept of happiness was inextricably connected towards the social obligations he had towards other people.
Well, what gives you job satisfaction, if I might ask?
Well, I'm ashamed to say it's the it's the buzz I get from standing up and teaching children, teaching students. That would be my instinctive reaction. I think at a deeper level, though, I'd say when I look back, if you were to say to my wife and I, what is the greatest joy that we have from our relationship to Grove City College, where I teach, we would say it's opening our home up for hospitality to the students. Mm-hmm. A couple of times a semester, we just have these open houses. And any students in my classes who want to come can come and hang at our house and enjoy desserts and sit on the deck and talk about anything. We take real joy in hospitality And that, I think, is a more admirable joy than the one I take merely from getting a buzz from standing in front of the classroom.
Sure.
Because there, sure. I think, what we're doing is we're investing in other people. We're trying to help other people come to grasp some of the joys of life that we were fortunate to be schooled in when we were at college.
You gave a great example in Psalms of how scripture can help you in some ways reinterpret your own emotional experience or understand your emotional experience. And I was wondering if you had any other examples, either from your Christian faith or from your philosophical musings, that have also helped you give an interpretive lens to any kind of emotional experience.
Yeah, well, I think the Psalms, for Christians and Jews alike, the Psalms are an absolutely central text because they are full of emotion. Well, what's interesting about the Psalms is that emotion is always set in the context of broader external realities, specifically the reality of God. Psalm 88, if listeners want to look up Psalm 88, it is the bleakest psalm in the Psalter. It's full of despair. It ends with the psalmist lamenting that all his friends have been taken from him. But what's interesting is the psalm begins using in Hebrew the covenant name of God. So as the psalmist begins this lament, it's all set within the context of him recollecting the Lord's dealing with the nation of Israel. I don't mean that in the modern sense. With the Jews in the Old Testament. So I've learned a lot from the Psalms in terms of, we have these emotions and it's okay to have emotions. It's okay to even feel moments of darkness and despair, but ultimately one sets them in the context of an external reality. Philosophically, I think I've learned a very similar thing through reading works of people like Roger Scruton. Roger Scruton's emphasis upon the externalities of place and location, I think, has been very helpful to me to think, one mustn't think of oneself as an isolated individual. One must always understand that one is set in a place, that the emotional struggles perhaps that we have are not to be, we don't have to go through them alone. We can go through them as part of a community, as part of something that has roots. That's becoming rarer and rarer, I think, in our rather disembodied and uprooted society. But it should be part of the human experience. One of the things that I would be critical of Rousseau on a whole host of fronts, but one of the things that I think Rousseau gets right is human beings are to have a natural empathy for each other. And that means that griefs and agonies and pains and joys and delights can and should be shared and born together.
Question six is, who's writing your life story?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I think two somewhat antithetical people in some ways. I think one, Roger Scruton. I think he's been a guiding light for me for many years now in terms of his emphasis upon place and upon the joys of ordinary life. I start my humanities class with the students. I say, what if part of the answer to the meaning of life is not an idea? What if it's sitting on your deck, sharing a good bottle of red wine with close friends? And I think that's something I learned from Roger Scruton, learning to take joy in the small things and find meaning, the most meaning perhaps, in the immediate relationships and friendships we have. The other person, and this may come as a bit of a surprise, Karl Marx. It's always important to have worthy opponents. It's always important to have worthy opponents that you respect. And I think for me, Marx has been the worthy opponent that I respect. And I've seen a lot of my, certainly over the last decade or so, a lot of my life and thinking is shaped by wanting to prove him wrong on a lot of points.
Mm-hmm. Question seven. Do you own your shit or does your shit own you?
I like to think I own it, but that's probably a question best answered by my wife or by my students, I guess. I think we all like to think we're in charge, but probably it's one of the reasons why I don't put anything on the internet these days that doesn't go through an editor, because we all tend to think we're in control. And I want my editors to weed out the bits where Truman's silliness comes through a bit too strong, where Truman's silliness has come to seize control of Truman. Well, I have a good marriage where I can talk to my wife. I can run things past her. To say I heavily depend upon editors with everything I write. I spend most of my life reading things that I disagree with, that I think is useful. And I've always taken the view that there's no point engaging the second strongest argument against any position I might hold. You've always got to look for the strongest argument and deal with that on its own terms. So I suppose I try to engage in as much self-policing as I possibly can by exposing myself to things that challenge me at the on things that I hold very, very deeply and very dearly. Does that get you?
Sure. Well, one of the things I'm always curious to ask people about is what kind of techniques they use if they can come to the moment they recognize, oh my God, I'm in the grips of those parts of myself that are really problematic.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah.
And how do I then unloosen that grip or deal with that?
Yeah, I think apologizing is often a good way of doing that. I remember years ago at college, one of my history professors referred to some scholar, and he said, when you're proved wrong on something, there are three ways of responding. He says, you can own up to it, you can accept it, and you can change your opinion. He said, secondly, you can just stop speaking on that subject and go quiet. And he said, those first two options, both of them are perfectly acceptable in the academic world. He said, what you must never do is continue to dig yourself in deeper.
Yeah.
And I think it's the way I've tried to put that into practice is I have five or six people in my life, the scholarly world and the personal world, whose opinion I really value. And I take, if they praise me, I'm pleased. If they criticize me, I take it very seriously. Other people, whether they praise or criticize me, I ignore them. Uh-huh. So I would say I have a team of people. They don't know they're my team, but they are people to whose opinion I would intuitively defer. So that's how I try to keep myself policed.
Yeah, well, that must be a great relationship. Insofar as that they are comfortable to tell you hard truths. I think that's part of the challenge for us is finding people in our lives who are willing to let us know. I mean, our spouses are happy to do that, but.
Yes, more than happy. And I think it goes to something else we've sort of lost in modern society, and that is true deep friendships. That you could do a whole podcast on that. I fear that a lot of people today don't have true friends. They either have sycophants or they have lots and lots of superficial relationships. What we really need in life is true friends who are willing to speak hard truths to us. But because they're our friends, we know that those hard truths are spoken in a way that is not designed to destroy us, but is designed to actually strengthen us and make us better.
All right, why don't we move on to question eight, which is how do you find love?
For me, primarily in family. Mm-hmm. I'm very blessed to have just celebrated my 32nd wedding anniversary. Still married to the woman I fell in love with 32 years ago. I keep telling her I have to die first, because if she dies, I will physically continue, but I will die at that moment. With my children and with my granddaughter. So I find love in real family embodied relationships.
I think earlier you were talking about Augustine and other notions of love. I was wondering if we could come back to that as well. The Greeks had a lot of different words for love, and one of them was, I always don't know if I'm pronouncing this right. Is it agape or a game? I think it's agape.
Agape. I've heard it pronounced numerous different ways.
So. Yeah. Which is this idea of, love as transcendent act, love of the divine. And I'm wondering if you, you mentioned this earlier, and I was wondering if you could elaborate on that a little bit about, like, there is the filial love that comes with our family. And there are different kinds of love that are out there. And I'm very curious about sort of a spiritual love and what spiritual love means.
Well, I think, again, going back to Augustine, begins his confessions with the famous statement that the heart is restless above all things until it finds rest in thee. And I would say, as we look around the world, we see a lot of restlessness. We feel it in our own hearts. We certainly see it on the streets of America. We see it in all of the scenes that come up on the news on a nightly level, that the human race does not seem to be at ease with itself and never has been. We look back through history. It makes me, I wouldn't say smile, but when I hear today America say, the nation's never been more divided, well, you had a civil war in the middle of the 19th century. You might be slightly more divided then. But history is really the history of human restlessness. And Augustine is making the point there that for human beings to find rest is to find their rest in God. Why? Because God has created us for communion with him. That communion has been disrupted, and it's only by recovering that communion that we find true rest. And how does love fit into that? Well, communion with God is the loving and the desiring of God above all things, seeing him as the great end, as the thing that gives shape to our lives, seeing him as that which we desire to move ourselves towards. And that would be the transcendent love of the Christian faith, that ultimately that kind of love cannot be lavished on the finite things of this world. It can only be found connecting to the reality of God.
If I could follow up, and if you don't want to answer this question, that's fine. But I'm curious for people who have faith and faith that we are living in God's creation. And this is a classic conundrum, which is, if we are living in God's creation, yet we see all of the suffering and the misery and the dysfunction around us, and then how do we reconcile that aspect of the abhorrent or the distasteful aspects of our reality with a love of God?
And I'm
actually curious, personally, if you have anything you want to share on that, because I would be very intrigued to hear.
Sure. Well, the Christian answer, of course, is that the world is not as it should be. We live in a fallen world, a world where humanity has turned away from God, and we would see the torments, the disruptions of this world as a result of humanity turning away from God. That raises then the next and the obvious question. So why did we turn away? Where does, which is a variation, where does evil come from?
Yeah.
To which the Christian answer is, we just don't know. Milton provides a sort of answer as he builds on the Jewish legend that you have this rebellion of angels in heaven. But that merely shoves to put it in biblical terms, it merely takes the problem from the Garden of Eden and pushes it up into heaven. It doesn't really solve the problem. So I would say, if we're asking the question, you're asking the existential question, which rests upon the metaphysical question of why evil, where does it come from? I think the Christian answer is, we don't know. But we look to the divine solution. Where does the Bible deal with the problem of evil? It's not actually by taking us back to the origins of the problem of evil. It's by taking us to the cross at Calvary. And the New Testament teaches that this evil, this disruption, this chaos we see, has been overcome by God himself, becoming subject to precisely that chaos. What more evil is there than death itself? What more chaotic force is there in our lives than death itself? You know, the loss of a loved one. I hate the rising practice among some Christians of funerals as celebrations of life. I take the view, if life's worth celebrating, the death has to be worth mourning. Because when a loved one dies, it wreaks havoc on the lives of those left behind. We're all reduced by it. So when God himself undergoes undergoes death and rises on the other side, there is a triumphant yes, I think, asserted over against this chaos. Now, listeners might say, yes, but children still die of cancer. People still get mugged on the streets of America. There's still conflict in the Middle East. To which, again, the Christian answer would be, well, yes, what we've seen on the cross is D-Day. We've not yet seen the consummation. The consummation will come at the end of time when all things will be put right. To which the objection will be, well, is that not a trite answer? And then I think it comes down to, it's a matter of faith. I can't persuade you by argument that that's true. It's ultimately something that one believes or one doesn't.
And so for you then, in terms of your own personal experience, is the, as you go through these various permutations in your head, do you ultimately, is that faith something that then just transcends rationality? How do you experience that faith moment?
I would say it transcends reason, but does not contradict reason. Faith does not require me to believe that a triangle has four sides, if I could put it that way. Uh-huh. Faith requires me to believe in a resurrection. And I don't think a resurrection contradicts. I've never seen anyone resurrected, but it doesn't seem to me irrational to believe that somebody could be resurrected by an all-powerful God. So I would say it is beyond reason. But then we get into the question of, is it contrary to reason or is it consistent with reason?
All right, we're on to our final question, which is, where are you going from here?
Well, academically, I'm currently working on a couple of projects. I'm doing a book on the origins of critical theory, which I've always wanted to do because it allows me to wrestle with my worthy opponent, Karl Marx, his works of the 1840s. And I think the debates about critical theory in our society at the moment, they're key, particularly for young people. What do you do with critical race theory? What do you do with gender theory, et cetera, et cetera? I'm also wanting, I put together an outline of a book on nihilism and ressentiment in modern culture, because I think one of the things that most characterizes our modern, particularly political discourse, is the sort of seething resentments that the word ressentiment captures. Uh-huh. And a certain nihilism, not in the technical philosophical sense, but in a sort of, is anything worth, put it this way, is anything worth dying for today? So that's what I'm working on professionally. But in terms of my broader goal, my great love is professionally is the classroom, teaching students. And I always take the view, when I teach a class, if in a class of 30 students, I can have just two or three who leave that class loving reading Marx, Nietzsche, the great classics of the tradition, loving reading the Bible, loving thinking great thoughts, if I can just have two or three in every class and everything like that, then the job has been worthwhile. So I hope, you know, what does the future hold for me at the moment? More of the same, I hope. More of the same.
That's great. This is a great conversation. I'm really appreciative of your openness and your intellectual curiosities and interests. If there was anything else we didn't touch on that.
No. I mean, I think that my mantra at the moment with my students, everyone is, you know, we need to recapture the ability for people who disagree and differ on some pretty serious things, yet to engage in a friendly and constructive manner. And I think this podcast, I think we've been going for an hour. I've had a blast. I think it was great fun.
Yeah.
Hopefully it will be a model to others of what we should all be striving to do.
I agree. That's one of its intents too. So trying to build dialogue across gulfs.
And ironically, of course, the academic world is the world where dialogue is being kind of closed down in certain places at the moment, which is annoying, to put it mildly.
Yeah, it's funny, like being, I it's hard for me because I don't know how much of it, I'm just, because I'm in Chicago where, yeah, you know, kind of free expression is so highly valued as a sort of central mode of the institution. And if I'm shielded from, you know, some of the slings and arrows that my colleagues at other institutions.
University of Chicago, from what I read, has handled things really well. Some of my friends who teach at Ivy Leagues have had very different experiences, I think.
Yeah. And it's not to say, I mean, there's tumult at the university, but there is, I guess the looming specter of cancel doesn't loom so large there.
Right.
And so I'm still from that. I'm always uncertain of what to make of all of this, because I get a lot of people are always asking me, oh, it's like, you know, are you feeling this? Are you experiencing this? And I'm like, no.
That's great. Know,
we actually really enjoy pretty healthy, open. And even in those instances, I won't put this on the podcast, but I'm director of undergraduate studies for my department. And I had a student who, it turns out, really didn't like the grade she got in a class. And it was a class on theories of race, and it was taught by a white professor. Yeah. And she said, you know, well, he has implicit bias.
Yes.
And I was like, well, I can't do anything for you about it. I mean, if it's implicit, that's, you know, that's ultimately a subjective experience. Yeah. And your concern isn't widespread. And, you know, I didn't say this to her directly. I said, but, you know, is your concern because you got a B- in the class?
They've had something to do with it, possibly.
Yeah. But, you know, whereas I think in other institutions, you know, I think that sort of settled it there. I was able to sort of just very, you know, explicitly say,
that's true.
But I think that's, I don't know how widely that, you know, the ability to sort of say, well, that's not an adjudicable contention. Well, thank you so much for coming on and sharing your wisdom and giving the time to the podcast and just your great answers to the questions.
Thanks very much. Great to meet you too, and stay in touch.
Okay, sure thing. Take care.
If you feel like you're getting a lot out of our show, there's another University of Chicago Podcast Network show you should check out. It's called Entitled. Human rights matter, but conversations about rights can be polarizing, confusing, and frustrating. On Entitled, lawyers Claudia Flores and Tom Ginsburg have traveled the world getting into the weeds of global human rights debates. They use that expertise to explore the stories and thorny questions around why rights matter and what's the matter with rights. Subscribe to Entitled, part of the award-winning University of Chicago Podcast Network.